Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for May 18th and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 718 and ask our two illustrious senators in the room to join us.
And for the record, Mr. Chair, we do have a constituent on the phone that wants to speak to this bill. His name is Bruce Larson, after the senator speak.
And would you please tell us
about
what this
bill
is all about?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 718A limits the public comment period for premium rate filings by individual portability or small employer health insurances to health benefit plans being offered by those insurers. Specifies that if the average premium rate filing is 7% or greater and affects 1,000 or more enrollees in the individual and small employer markets, the insurer shall, within three business days, notify all policyholders affected by the filing. It also requires the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to post to the website, DCBS's website, detailed explanation for the approval of any health insurance rate filing, any rate premium increases, and make consideration of certain criteria relating to the approval of such increases mandatory.
Before we start, I just want to warn the folks in the audience, we have a lot of work today and a lot of witnesses, so I'm going to ask you all to hold your comments to about 3 minutes and don't necessarily repeat what everybody else repeats, but everybody knows senators can't hold their comments to 3 minutes, so we'll excuse them. Gentlemen.
Yeah, why don't you?
Well, thank you, Chair Greenluck and Chair Thompson. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Senator from District 6 in Springfield, Lynn, Lane County area. And I just wanted to be here today to add my support to Senate Bill 718, which is directed at trying to shed a little more sunlight on the insurance process. I think it used to be more open. Certainly, as I don't have to tell you folks, you because you've been working on health care, the costs have been rising, and we need to do everything we can to try to keep those costs under control. And certainly adding a little sunlight helps that process a lot. The one thing I would say is that from my 9 years of experience chairing the Public Utility Commission, I learned a lot about what the sunlighting process and bringing interveners into the process to ask the right questions helps the regulator see some points that they may overlook otherwise. And I think what this bill does in a small way is it certainly notifies or requires that the commissioner notify people buying insurance from a company when a large increase is proposed, and it provides a process for them to make comments and intervene in that, and it requires that the commissioner consider those comments in making, in this case, her decision. So I think this is a good thing. It helps the process, and I would urge you to support this bill.
Yeah, let's not move anything today.
Any questions for Senator Beyer? Senator, what does it mean to require them to consider the comments? What's the weight of that?
Well, the way I would interpret that, Mr. Chair, is that the current law, as I understand it, and actually Senator Shields is much more informed about this than I am, he's worked on it, but it says they may consider. And I think there's a legal difference between may consider and must consider. Essentially, as I would take it, they have to provide a written explanation posted on their website of what the rate increase was and how they got there. And in that process, it, at the very least, it requires them to go through addressing that point. I'm more familiar with how we did that in more of a quasi-judicial setting in the utility business. In that business, we would have all of the issues flushed out. It was a much more open court-like procedure. But we would, in issuing our orders on our decision, address every single point that was raised by an intervener and explain how the commission reacted to that. I would expect a similar process in the insurance business.
That was all a part of your findings in this.
It's part of the findings.
Thank you. Senator Shields?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent Senate District 22 in the Oregon Senate. To modify Senator Beyer's comments just a little bit, what the bill will require it will change from may to must the factors that the insurance commissioner must consider. There are a list of factors, surplus, administrative overhead, things like that, that the insurance commissioner must consider. Senate Bill 718 is one of a package of health insurance improvement bills, Senate Bill 717, 718, and 719, that my committee worked on diligently over the course of the session. As you may know, the insurance division has the authority to approve, disapprove, or modify health insurance premium increases in the individual, small group, and portability markets. This bill addresses the individual and small group markets where the bulk of small business owners reside. The bill passed out of the Senate on a bipartisan basis 25-5, and it's the simpler of the health insurance rate review bills. It's more of a good government bill that essentially does three things. One, it requires for the insurance commissioner to provide a detailed rationale that addresses the legal standards for approving or disapproving or modifying the rates. It does change the may consider certain factors to must consider certain factors like administrative expenses as well as surplus, et cetera. And thirdly, it requires that the insurance companies notify policyholders when the carrier files a large increase, 7% or more, and affecting 1,000 policyholders or more. Because there's a 30-day comment period, but since that comment period has been introduced, there are a large number of policyholders that don't even know it exists. So this would allow policyholders to participate in this very public process, and it would give a small business person more time to plan for what would be a very large increase. I also passed out some articles to you regarding 717, which we'll have a hearing tonight in the Ways and Means Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee, a packet on some of the articles in the paper on 717 and 718. And when you put those two bills together, essentially the premises of these bills are this, that these issues are too important to small business to have happen behind closed doors. And secondly, from Senator Byer's experience, it's another premise is that those who are represented tend to get a better deal. And I think Senator Byer has seen that in his work in the Public Utility Commission, where people represented by the Citizens Utility Board tend to get a better deal. People represented by the industrial customers of the Northwest tend to get a better deal. And what 717 would allow is for small businesses to elbow their way to the table. This is the other bill that will be heard this evening. Elbow their way to the table and provide a second opinion on whether or not these large premium increases are truly justified. So the testimony we heard, and which you'll hear later, is that small businesses are drowning, and they really want to feel like they can participate in this very public process, provide a second opinion, and make health insurance companies justify their premium increases. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Shields. Other discussion of Senator Shields?
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you.
I think we'll take the testimony now of the person on the phone to allow him to get off the phone. I believe it's Mr. Lawson. Is that correct?
Yes, Bruce Lawson.
Go for it.
Okay. My wife and I, Barbara and Bruce Lawson, do support 718. We are a small business here in Mount Hare County. We operate a full-service fireworks display company. I'd like to make it open and clear that our premiums have nothing to do with the business that we're in.
They don't skyrocket?
They're the bare minimum what we have here, what we got on our insurance. And my deal and support for 718 is because the fact that we are a small business, which we operate off of an operating loan year to year, high premiums, not knowing what these premiums are from year to year until we sit down and we are shocked when we do our taxes. It's just hard to be planning ahead for these types of costs. One of the requirements through my bank is that for this line of credit that I do carry health and medical insurance. And again, this has nothing to do with our business. It's just, you know, it makes good sense. And, of course, we want to do what's good for my family and that. But I'll get off the phone here. But we do support 718. I appreciate Senator Shields for what he's doing here. And thank you for your time.
Mr. Lawson, we appreciate you testifying. We understand it's a long way to come, so we were happy that we could hear from you by phone today.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Okay. I think we have one more person to testify.
Three.
I sense in favor, and then four more I sense who are opposed, although it doesn't exactly say that. Diane Frank, would you like to join us?
Is this microphone working? I'm not sure how to
yes.
work
yeah,
it.
Yeah, don't
okay,
get too
huh?
close to it.
Oh, okay. My name is Diane Frank. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm a small business person. I've been self-employed all of my adult life. In my former life in Eugene, I owned a retail store where we provided health insurance for our employees. We were able to do so. Today, those same employees would be either self-insured or go uninsured because the cost would be completely unaffordable. Escalating costs are becoming unsustainable for small business people and individuals like myself. I want to talk to you a little bit about how they're impacting me. In October of 2007, I paid $273 a month for my health insurance. In October of 2009, it was in the 300s, and I'm in 8, and in 9, it was in the 400s. In October of 2010, my premiums went up to $580 a month. I have been informed by my health care provider, LifeWise, that in 2011 I can expect a minimum of another 15% increase, which will take them to $667 a month, more than one-third of my monthly income. It is unsustainable. That is a 150% increase over 4 years in the cost of health insurance premiums to small business people and individuals like myself. In addition, I carry a high deductible, and the first $10,000 of any medical crisis or accident will come out of my pocket on top of these premiums. It's unsustainable. Small businesses have no leverage. They can't shop around. They have no clout. They have no ability to fight these rates. We're at the mercy of the insurance companies. I'm a light user of the system. I'm 62. I have nowhere else to go. They won't take someone like myself trying to move around. When I talk to people from the health insurance companies and ask why these premium raises are so steep, they have no answers. It's really not unreasonable to expect them to explain and justify these incessant rate increases. It is not unreasonable to expect notification of these rate increases so people can plan for them. Transparency and accountability are not unreasonable expectations. People like myself, we have been bending and bending and bending under these rate increases, but now we're starting to break. I strongly support Senate Bill 718A and hope that you consider giving people like myself and other small business people and individuals some relief. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Why don't we have Elise Brown and Lisa Trussell next, and after that we'll have Mike Becker and Carrie Smith.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. Elise Brown here representing America's Health Insurance Plans, and here to just offer some general comments in opposition to Senate Bill 718. As the cost of health insurance continues to rise in Oregon and across the nation, so do insurance premiums. Oregon is lucky to have a competitive market that keeps our premium costs at a lower end across the nation. DCBS, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, reviews health insurance rates on policies held by 12% of Oregonians, and it's known to have the most transparent rate filing process in the nation. It is for that reason that we do not see the need for this bill. For background, in 2009, this legislature, as part of health care reform, made significant changes to the rate review process. These changes were intended to provide accurate data on factors driving costs and generally allow the public to participate in and understand the rate review process. Some of the key factors in that process include, number one, the department posts its rate filings on the website. A layperson, in plain language, provides an explanation that is included in each filing to help consumers understand the basics of the filing. And in addition to that, with a new federal grant, the division has hired Osberg to also provide input on key rate requests. At the time of the rate filing on the website, two dates are triggered. First of all, a 30-day comment period begins. And this is where policyholders have an opportunity to sign up for e-notify. They receive an email when their insurer files, and then they also receive an email when the department has rendered a decision. I went to the website today to actually sign myself up so I learn when my carrier, Aetna, is going to make their rate filing increase so that I'm prepared and ready to watch when that happens. It's a very clear, open process, and I'm happy to share copies of how you access the website. But when you do, you get an email that tells you that your carrier has just filed for a rate increase. It tells you that you have 30 days to file and offer your comments. It also tells you where to go to review comments on the filing so you can see what other people have said about that rate filing. The division also has 40 days to review the filing and then issue its decision. Besides making the filings public, Oregon has taken great steps to provide consumers with more information about health care costs to help make them help them with more informed decisions about their health care. Some of those examples are something exciting that we all passed a couple sessions ago, which now requires carriers to provide their members with out-of-pocket cost estimates for common medical procedures through an interactive website. I think you can hear Lisa Trussell maybe give an example of that in HealthNet. OID's annual report, the Health Insurance in Oregon Report, is a great document that this legislative body receives at the beginning of each legislative session. And finally, the state is now working on an all-claims database, which gives consumers even more information. So I appreciate Senator Shields bringing the bill forward. We would suggest that many of those ideas in the bill are already there and used by OID. So we would hope that this bill not move forward. We do not need to increase administrative costs both for OID and for the carriers, and some of those examples would be the call volume coming into both the carriers and OID over confusion with an additional notification going out, postage, double mailings, and so on. So I think ultimately the consumer loses. So those are my general comments. I have one of my AHIP members here, and I know that you'll be hearing from Providence following that. So I'll pass it over to Lisa.
Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with HealthNet Health Plan of Oregon, and here also in opposition to Senate Bill 718 for many of the reasons that Ms. Brown already articulated. But I think that a couple of the things that I, or at least one of the points I want to make is that the concern is not so much the administrative expense of sending another mailing, although that is a cost. The issue is the confusion generated by the notice, because depending on where the member lives, for a small group particularly, where they live, what policy they've selected, because within individual market and small group market, we have a variety of policies, and other factors, their specific rate increase can be different from the average that's being sent out. and the range can fluctuate greatly for that as well. And the concern is if somebody only remembers when they receive their postcard or notice about the rate increase that somebody had said that they were sending in a 20% increase and their particular rate increase ended up to be 27%, that's going to generate calls wondering why the postcard said 20 and their actual one was 27. Those calls will go to the insurance division, to their consumer folks.
Your company doesn't have the computer capability to send out what the rate increase on the individual policies would be?
That's not what this bill requires.
So you would send out a confusing announcement rather than...
We would send out the notice that complies with the requirements of the bill. So, because if it goes into the insurance code, we have to send what they script for us. An example of that was the premium tax notice. We had to send a scripted notice on that.
So you're saying they would not allow you to send out on what the actual increase would be for that individual policy?
Mr. Chair, I didn't ask my people if we could do it on an individual member basis. I asked them to review the language and tell me what it would mean, and based on the language, that's what they did.
So you'd be happy with the bill if the language said you should notify them specifically what their rate increase would be?
Mr. Co-Chair, that was not a question I asked when we were reviewing this bill. We reviewed the bill as it was written. The other thing is that, as you can see from page 2 of the bill, there's a long list of factors that the insurance division already considers, and these factors remain the same. They've just changed the may to a shall. The insurance rates are going up, and no one is happy about that, but rates are going up because medical trend is going up at about 12% a year. And in fact, the average rate increase for 2010 in the small group market...
Excuse me a moment.
Okay, great. Was 11.7%. And the interesting thing to me about that number is that number mirrors what the PEB trend has been, as it's been reported in the newspaper. The other point I'd like to make is that... carrier profits over the last 10 years have averaged 2%. And I'm not sure about specific companies and such, but from the insurance report, it says that those profits are coming from the groups that aren't regulated, don't fall under rate regulation. So we just think it's an unnecessary mailing. I would like to show you that I pulled one of our recent filings off of the website that Elise referred to. And here's the information that is currently out there. We have to file something similar for each rate filing we do. So
that's all open to the public?
Yes, it's on. I pulled it off their website. It's very user-friendly because I'm not very high-tech, and I got it.
Representative Pierce?
Thank you. Elise, do you work for Aetna, or did you say you have Aetna as your personal insurance carrier?
I don't, actually. My husband works for Bank of America, and that's our carrier
His
insurance.
Right. Can I follow up? You know, we heard a testimony, you know, that healthcare costs are going up, and there's, you know, I'm not going to advocate for one industry over another, but there's a lot of, you know the insurance companies are, you know, costing us a lot of money in their increased profit. I'm looking at the, glad you don't represent it, because I pulled up their security exchange filings, and quite frankly, their profits are flat. If you look at gross net income to operating costs, you know, 1 year they're 4%, 1 year they're 0.0367%, and 1 year they're 0.05% of the profit margin. My margin in my company is significantly higher than this. So these are kind of razor-thin margins, and I'm not seeing an increase. And you said 2%. I'm seeing a little bit higher for this particular company that you said Aetna, so I pulled them up. Where are the cost drivers in healthcare that are causing the rate increases? Because if their income is flat and they're required to file this in this public filing, either A, they're not telling the truth, and they're making a lot more money, and their earnings per share right now are only 60 cents. So shareholders are only earning 15 cents a quarter on every share. I'm curious where the cost drivers are, and nobody, since we've had this conversation on a lot of bills.
Their losses in the stock market has been the major force that's kept their profits down.
That's probably a piece of it, but...
Mr. Co-Chair's Representative Parrish, if you will, according to OID, just a breakdown on the dollar...
Oregon Insurance Division.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Premium breakdown for 2010 shows that claims were a total of 89 cents on the dollar, administrative costs were 10 cents, and the remaining 1 cent was profit. So the cost, again, as to what Lisa said, our medical claims and the cost of health care is continuing to rise.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you did not have to do the mailing out to the people to notify that there is going to be a rate increase, would you be okay with this bill?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Widener, from our perspective, it's our understanding they're already looking at those factors, so it would not, the issue is the value of the notice requirement. So I think, although I haven't asked and I can get back to you, I think that we would probably be okay with that second page.
Okay. Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
So I think Senator Shields is trying to get to a point to make sure that there's no collusion going on in any of these rate increases, things like that. And would you be comfortable with, when there were rate increases over a certain amount, coming back here and meeting in front of a co-committee to let us know why you're doing the rate increases? Because one of the things we know that drives the cost of health care, a lot of it is cost shifting that's going on, and this is information that should be shared with us so we can realize when we're cutting reimbursement rates by 34%, like we're looking at right now in Medicare and Medicaid, that this is going to drive your rates up. So we need to see these things when we're balancing them, and I don't think DCBS takes that into consideration. And I think that's a direction Senator Shields is kind of wanting to go with this. Where we make those decisions because we have to vote on them here every day.
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Widener, I'm glad you mentioned the cost shift because clearly that's one of, especially for Oregon, that's one of the biggest cost drivers. And depending on who you talk to, it could be as much as 30% to 40% of premium increase. It clearly is a big issue. And as I understand it, Oregon has lower Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements than other states, which plays into that. The issue is clearly that medical trend, which is cost and utilization, is at about 12%, and I think around the country it's anywhere from 10 to 15%. So Oregon being at 12 is about in the middle of the pack on where trend is, and again, it's consistent with your own plan, PEB.
Representative Doherty?
Well, first of all, I don't have PEB, so I don't have insurance through the state. But, I question your 11% rate because I also have a family member who has to buy insurance for herself. And with LifeWise, it's gone up 22% in a year. And this is not in the Portland metropolitan area, but her deductible also went from $5,000 to $7,000 a year. And so what I do is, well, my question is when these rates go through, I got two questions. One, does the insurance department ever say, no, you're not going to get it? That you do not have the rationale to do it?
Co-chairs, Representative Doherty, that's another great question. I think you could probably expand on, therein lies the confusion. I don't know what the exact percentage of what the rate request is and what the final outcome is and what the differentiation is, but I think Lisa alluded to the confusion of what the rate request is and what the actual rate ends up being is always different.
Well, I mean, I've worked in contracts for 30 years, and if I wanted 8%, I went in with 15.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't know if the insurance companies are doing the same thing, but this is being passed on to the consumer, and I'm real concerned about the rationale of it because I certainly don't see healthcare providers, if you have an 11% increase, getting an 11% increase in their rates and that kind of thing. I don't see the transparency in the insurance industry when it comes to rates or the justification. So if I'm wrong, you know, if you guys really have to go through and justify specifically, detail by detail, this is why I'm asking for a 10% every quarter kind of rate increase.
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Doherty, as a matter of fact, and I'd be happy to leave this with you because I can pull another one off the Internet. I'm pretty good with it now. But this has... this is the rating information. All the information has to be submitted with the rating, and it is verified by actuaries at the insurance division. And as to the point about denying a rate increase, I'm not sure that, I mean, they could deny a rate increase if the carrier is unwilling to discuss with them and they just think that, you know, actuarially, whatever the carrier submitted, if OID believed that it wasn't accurate and worked, and the carrier wasn't willing to adjust, then yes, it could be denied. But it wouldn't be a carrier exiting the market is not typically in the best interest of the consumers. Recently, and I'm trying to remember what we ended on, and people who get the emails probably could tell me, but we had a lengthy discussion with the Oregon Insurance Division on a 2% projected profit on a group that I think was relatively small actuarially. They were saying it wasn't statistically valid sample. I think it was 5,000 lives. And I believe that we ended up saying, okay, we'll project a 1% increase and drop the premium. But it's been the focus of the agency in the past, and I think that that still should be the focus, is financial solvency of the carriers. And what happens if you artificially are told to reduce your rates, what will happen is that your prices won't keep up, and then you're going to hit a bubble. And I understand, and this was before my days in the industry, that that's what happened in, I think it was the individual market in 2006. So rates were artificially reduced, and then that caused the bubble that started in 2008. And as I understand it, 2009 and 2010 have flattened out to about 15%, where they were over 20% in 08 and 09, I believe.
Any last follow-up?
Yes.
But you still do not have to justify why you're having double-digit increases.
And that's what we do with this rate filing.
No, to your the people that have the insurance. You don't have to go through and justify. You don't have to go through and say, this is what my CEO makes, this is what the people below makes, this is what our reimbursement is, this is what we have in reserve, you know, all of that kind of thing, because it is, the consumer is really the one that is being hurt through this, and I appreciate insurance companies and what they do and what they cover, but I question whether the, whether the rate increases are truly quantifiably justified to the consumer and to the people of Oregon. And that's just that's more of a statement than a question. But I think this is what this bill does, is it makes sure you're going to have to go through and do a little more justification. Rate increases.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Shelby. Really brief. The reasons for cost increases in healthcare are complicated. I think this committee understands there's not a single reason that we're seeing these 10 or 20% increases. And I hope that we will come back to that conversation, as I think Representative Parrish suggested during the interim. But perhaps the only time that a consumer might be able to push back against an increase, or at least find out why there's an increase, whether or not it has to do with insurance companies and reserves and profits and stock market losses or underlying trends in medical inflation, perhaps the only time would be at one of these very rare hearings. And it seems to me that what this bill proposes is to give consumers notice that a hearing is going to take place, that it may affect them, and that your suggestion that these notices are going to generate confusion for a consumer because they might say, look, here's what we're proposing for a rate increase for people like you, maybe not your individual plan, but for people like you, here's your opportunity to comment on it, that's going to be confusing. I think your companies are better than that. I think our consumers, our constituents, are smarter than that. Mm-hmm. We can get it. We can look at it and say, okay, maybe 10%, maybe me, here's a hearing, I can show up. I find this really troubling that there's this level of resistance to a notice requirement.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Mike Becker and Carrie Smith. Carrie Smith, is that right? Yes. Chip, you want a minute to sum up when we're done?
Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson and members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Providence Health and Services. With me today to deliver the testimony is Carrie Smith, our Director of Regulatory Compliance and Government Affairs for Providence Health Plan.
Thank you. Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson and members of the committee. As Mike said, I'm Carrie Smith, and I'm responsible for our regulatory compliance and government affairs area at Providence Health Plan, and I really appreciate the opportunity to give input today on Senate Bill 718. I'll keep my comments very short to use your time wisely here. First, I just want to start out by saying that Providence Health Plan is supportive of finding meaningful and reasonable steps towards increasing the transparency and effectiveness of the rate review process, but we just don't think this bill gets us there. And similarly to the past, the people that just testified were very concerned about some of the unintended consequences of this bill. Our primary concern, again, is the impact to our members and policyholders. We really do believe that the notification requirement outlined in this bill will really create a lot of confusion and angst for our members. And the reason is, and you know, as was just noted, we're required to give kind of the average, kind of unspecified rate. And because we don't have the exact rates because of all the things we talked about, you know, plan, age, experience, it's just an average that we'll be able to provide at that time. Since it has to go out within 3 days, it hasn't been approved yet. So we're just very concerned that people are going to see that and say, oh, gosh, my rate's going up 6%. Maybe it indeed is 12, or maybe it's 2. And we really can't answer those questions for them when they start calling us. Granted, they will hear that we are submitting a rate increase, but we just aren't going to be able to give them enough information. So we're concerned about that, and I really think it will be more harmful than helpful. Our secondary concern is the additional administrative cost due to the production and mailing of the notices, as well as the increased phone calls to the carriers and the division. And, of course, and you've heard this time and time again, increased admin costs ultimately equate to higher premiums, and we don't want that. You know, we're trying to avoid that. So for these two reasons, we do oppose this bill. We are, however, willing to work with you in the insurance division to identify meaningful, efficient ways to engage consumers in the rate filing process, because we do know how important that is. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
No questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Chip, you want 1 minute?
No questions?
Representative,
I'm sorry.
Have
a question.
Yes.
There is a question.
You didn't get away that easily.
Just I know Providence is a little different model and everything, but one of the things I've wondered, because I saw you kind of nodding back there with the cost shifting that goes on, how come the insurance industry doesn't just leave it up to the market and you say this is what we're going to pay for X service? We pay $100 for a doctor visit, and then the customer has to go out and start shopping doctors who are going to provide that service for that amount, and that way you don't get caught up in all this cost shifting that goes on. And just, well, I know a lot of places have stopped taking Medicaid already, and hospitals are seeing them, but you need to overcome what's happening and what's driving your rates up. And is that ever discussed in your board meetings or looking at doing something like that?
Yeah, co-chairs, Representative Widener and members of the committee. You know, that's a really good question. I think what we really come across often with is, you know, we need to have provider networks. We need to have providers available for our members. If we start telling our providers, look, this is all we're going to pay you, we might lose them. And so it's kind of a constant struggle to make sure we have the provider network and the providers available for our members. And so that's the struggle we have. But absolutely, that's something that we look at constantly. Do you have anything to add, Mike?
Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, may I also respond to that?
Please.
Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, Representative Widener, I'm sorry. The other thing in regard to that issue is that health care service contractors which is the legal type of entity that Providence Health Plan is, are required by statute to hold members harmless. And that is one of the requirements that we have with our network. And the negotiated rates, covered services, there is that hold harmless requirement. So we can't throw our members to the whims of the market and say, we're only paying this amount, you go negotiate a rate with the provider.
Guys, we've got seven bills to handle, and we're right. 45 minutes into it.
Thank you very much.
Representative Parrish, do you have a brief
I'll
one?
I'll wait for Senator Shields, because I think it's more for him
okay.
than it is for insurance.
Okay. Yeah, 1 minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to just sum up. I think it, you know, we do like to come to you with negotiated settlements on legislation like this. I've reached out to the industry on a couple of occasions, talked to the CEO of Providence Health System or Health Plans. I've talked to the person at Kaiser who does the marketing. And we tried to take their concerns into account, even though at the end of the day I knew they were going to oppose every one of these bills. I will tell you that I would be open to an amendment to the bill that would say that with one of their regular mailings that they're going to do, that they would just say, this is the website address for the insurance division. You can sign up for an email notification in the future when a premium increase is going to be proposed. That's an amendment that I would be open to if that would get the committee to yes. I also want to keep in mind that the argument that this would unfairly or unduly increase administrative expenses, keep in mind that there's $1.5 billion worth of premium in the individual and small group markets. And I think if you asked virtually every one of their small business customers, would you appreciate getting notice when we've put in a filing for a 22-23% premium increase? I bet virtually every single one of them would say, yeah, I'd like to get that notice in the mail. What's the point of having a 30-day comment period if nobody knows about it? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Chip.
This is my question.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Can you help me just I want to be, like, with you on this because I totally, as a consumer, and you know, when you get a rate increase for your cell phone or your health care or whatever, you want to kind of have a sense of why. But around health care, it seems like there is such angst and aggravation and outrage, if you will, about rate increases, and yet the price of a loaf of bread in the last 3 months has gone up double digits as a percentage, and we're not upset about groceries. And I think food is actually more basic right than healthcare, quite frankly. Yet we're not having a big conversation about regulating the price of bread. And literally, it's gone up 16% in 3 months. So, we have a lot of conversation about healthcare. Why do you feel like there's such angst around this as an issue versus what we're seeing in other market forces with increases when cost of goods are going up everywhere?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, I do think are some distinguishing factors in healthcare. One, in the individual market, where I would venture to say 60% of the individual market are probably small business people. They have a very inelastic demand. They'll pay what prices often put in front of them, because if you have a pre-existing condition, you can't bounce around from carrier to carrier depending on who gives you the best price. And small business, small group is a little bit different, but when you only have seven major carriers in a market, your choices, again, are limited, and you might not want to have your employees jumping from plan to plan every year, although that has become more of an issue.
Also, the CPI for medical care has been 2 to 3 times the CPI for food increase over the last decade.
And in closing, Mr. Chair, if I could just say, medical utilization across the country is down.
Chip, thank you very much for bringing this, and thanks for sitting in and hearing this session. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 718 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 204. And I think we have...
Well, they were outside, but...
Are they not?
Let me brief you on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 204 allows disclosure of identity of a person between health care providers and prepaid managed care health service organizations that are paid by the state health plan to provide care to a person. You have the A4s in front of you, which is Representative Kotek, and you also have the A5 amendments, and Senator Telfer is here to bring forth the A5 amendments, I believe, and then I think she has some... folks with her as
and,
well.
And let's,
can I bring my people up?
Well, and that's no, let's get you and Representative Kotek up to talk about your separate amendments, and let's try and keep this fast. Let me also point out that it's our intention to use House Bill, Senate Bill 204 as a vehicle for carrying amendments that some people need in this session, and at least the current plan, and our plans change frequently in the process, is to add any amendments to 204 that can get five votes, and then see if when we've created the Christmas tree with amendments on it, the whole bill can get five votes. But that's where we are at the plan at the moment. So we are accepting from our members amendments. And Dr. Bates, Senator Bates, has agreed that it's fine use of his bill. Senator Telfer?
Thank you, Co-Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson. I'm Senator Chris Telfer, representing District 27, also known as Sunny Central Oregon.
I know.
And a little number thing. I thought maybe dash 4 would go before dash 5.
We'll open up your bill as soon as they're done.
The more the merrier up here.
You want me to go first?
No, either of you.
Yeah. No. Okay, well, I've got folks here who can describe the amendment, the dash 5, a little bit more in depth. But what I do want to say is that in Central Oregon, we do a lot of regional things, and I'm proud to say that we also have a very, very creative, out-of-the-box, forward-thinking health care environment and community. And we've worked together on some of those priorities before. We have an opportunity here. We know the transformation, the healthcare transformation, is stumbling a little bit. We have an opportunity to continue to find ways to help our communities be healthier, and more economically sound. What we're asking for is a pilot program to basically allow my TAG students in healthcare to continue in that direction. Some of the successes that we've had is this group of various stakeholders in healthcare were named in 2009 as the first health integration project by the Oregon Health Authority Addiction and Mental Health Division. Some of the other successes in a emergency department diversion project, they had a 56% decrease in emergency department usage with high-frequency Medicaid patients during the first quarter of 2011 as compared to 2010. They've had over 500 high-utilizing emergency department patients regionally have care plans accessible through all regional emergency room medical records. In their preliminary results for their patient-centered medical home, they have a 13% decrease in ER utilization. They have a 15% decrease in inpatient medical utilization. They have a 40% increase in child immunization rate. They have 100% of care-coordinated patients with chronic disease received depression screening, and 80% generic refill rate. This is a very successful group of healthcare professionals, and we think this is a pilot program that can benefit the state and setting a model and direction as we move into trying to address our health care needs for Oregonians and the cost to them. So I will defer most of the details to them.
To people who follow. Excellent. Kotek?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. And for the record, I think the work they're doing in Central Oregon is fantastic, so I hope you support their amendment. So I have the dash A4 amendment to Senate Bill 204. You might remember this as language from House Bill 3559, which had a not so illustrious career in your committee. This amendment basically comes from what you had originally worked on that bill in the dash 3 amendment, I believe. There was one small change made in consultation with ambulatory surgical centers. I just want to make sure you know. But the components of the amendment in the Dash A4, similar to what we had worked on House Bill 3559, all DRG hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers in Oregon would be required to follow the most recent Medicare payment methodologies as outlined by rule by the Oregon Health Authority. The amendment, as in the other bill, permits flexibility from the health authority to allow for the use of alternate payment methodologies such as pay for performance and bundling. Section 3.1b also advises the health authority to take into consideration services and equipment that may not have payment methods in Medicare. This provides some flexibility to cover items that Medicare does not cover, such as implants used in knee and back surgery. The health authority under this amendment would be advised by a work group of providers, insurers, and consumers of the types of healthcare services that are subject to the methodologies. And the effective dates have been aligned to align with the effective dates for updated Medicare payment methodologies. So you see all DRG hospitals will start using the payment methodology October 1 of 2012. All ambulatory surgical centers would start using the payment methodology on January 1 of 2013. That's why you have different dates there. And insurers would have to attest to their compliance with this methodology to the Oregon Health Authority during the contracting process. So essentially, practically the same bill you had before. Would really appreciate having this amendment included in Senate Bill 204. This is about transparency, standardization, and ultimately a way to get a sense of what we are paying for in inpatient and outpatient care. Thank you, colleagues.
Any questions? Yes, sir.
Can you talk about its fiscal impact and where it saves money?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Kenmer, thank you for the question. I don't have the fiscal impact. I have not seen that, per se. My understanding is this would apply to the Oregon Health Plan, PEB, and OEB, and would save the state some money. I don't know the actual amount.
Yes. Yes. This might be for the chairs, but does Senator Bates know what's happening to his bill?
Yes, he does.
Uh-huh. Okay. I just wondered.
He's a fine. It was designed to do this on that side, and he's happy to have us do this to it.
I'm just seeing a minor bill turn into something big.
Yeah, exactly. That was the definite. That was the purpose of the minor bill, apparently.
So
everything no one can find is in this bill.
Yeah, I mean, but if we end up not to vote for an amendment, then there won't be an amendment on it.
And if I'm,
but he is okay with it.
Dash fours. Did somebody give those to you to bring forward, or are they somebody else's, or are they yours? Should I hold off on questions?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Widener, they're mine.
They are definitely hers.
Okay.
Okay. And yes?
I have some questions, a few questions on the Dash 4s, if I may. Are we just going to get in a hear of the, because there's some serious things in the Dash 4s that we're doing here.
There are, and I think we have no intention of moving this bill today, so what I suggest we do is schedule another hearing on it so we can get further information, and in the meantime, perhaps give Representative Kotick a chance to brief us as individuals in before we get it back. We will leave time to seriously consider that.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's some stuff we're looking at doing that, I mean, basically telling hospitals how to pay and what they're going to do, and, I mean, stuff you wouldn't do with any other industry that we're doing in this bill, so I have a lot of questions on it.
Great. Okay. All right. You'll be back?
Anytime.
All right. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, are you going to hear any more testimony today on this?
Yes, yeah. But first
I'm just trying to understand the process.
But first I'm going to open up the hearing so we can get Senator Johnson to testify.
Excellent.
Then we'll get back to hearing testimony from Ben and Lisa. Is there anybody else to testify on the Dash 4s? President Cote? Representative Cote? You know, is anybody else intending to testify on the Dash 4s?
No.
I think not. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
There are some
hands. Open up a public hearing on.
There's a couple.
There's hands.
Yes, we have two.
Okay, good. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 579 to allow Senator Johnson to testify, who's been putting in and out. Like a firefly.
Multitasking, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for your courtesy in allowing me to testify.
I am here before you on Senate Bill 579, and there are others that are going to testify as well. This is a bill that came out of committee unanimously and came across the Senate floor unanimously. What it does is, in the tradition of health care, we look to friends and family for direction in providing health care to loved ones who lack the capacity to speak for themselves. Hospitals at times receive into admission patients who have no family or friends to speak on their behalf during periods of incapacity or have no executed advance directive. Although emergency life and health-saving treatment may be provided on an immediate basis to an incapacitated person with no family or friends, such patients often have ongoing, though non-emergency, medical needs that require treatment to which the emergency doctrine does not apply. The guardianship system lacks the structure, speed, and narrow focus to ensure that patients who are alone have someone who will step in and speak for them to authorize health care treatment in a hospital setting. In some rural places, colleagues, like most of my district, there is no public guardianship. Most hospitals have trained health care professionals who are looked to for guidance in determining the substituted judgment or best interest of the incapacitated patient who is unbefriended with no family or friends. Designated health care professionals, while educated and trained to intervene in complex matters such as this, do not have the legal authority to authorize treatment decisions for the incapacitated person with no friends or family. And I just realized I probably didn't identify myself on the record. Sorry. I'm Betsy Johnson, Senate District 16. Colleagues, that's why we have brought you Senate Bill 579. The bill provides many safeguards so that the appointment of a health care provider is an act of last resort. First, the hospital must perform a reasonable search for relatives, friends, health care representatives, caseworkers, and health care directives. Second, if the patient's wishes regarding health care are known, the hospital must comply with these wishes. And third, if the patient's religious beliefs are known, the hospital must make a reasonable effort to confer with members of the clergy of that religious tradition. Lastly, under no circumstances, and I'll repeat, no circumstances, would the health care provider be able to consent to mental health treatment, sterilization, abortion, life-sustaining treatment, or the withdrawal or withdrawing of artificially administered nutrition and hydration. Senate Bill 579 will ensure that all hospitals act consistently when they care for the incapacitated, unbefriended patient. I thank the committee for hearing the bill, and I hope that you act on it favorably and move it forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Any comments? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Johnson, for the bill. I, Representative Hoyle, I actually jumped on the bill and everything. I have been approached about some amendments for it, and one of them would be, and I communicated a little bit with OHSU on this, but they were wanting somebody else rather than just the attending physician, a second opinion on any care or anything like that. And I'm kind of open to the amendment. I'm just wondering where you're at, but I'm still working through the details, so I don't know if I will go there or not.
I think others, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think others behind me will explain why that is probably not a practical solution, particularly in rural places where physicians have relationships with a hospital, and that is the hospital. I think in the interest of time and expeditious care of patients, that may pose a stumbling block, but I will let others behind me speak in more detail. The reason I'm giving a kind of superficial answer is that my next appointment is at 4, and it's one that I have to attend to. We just have discussed that amendment. I would share with you that all the way along, as the hospitals have come forward with various suggestions that makes the bill stronger, we have incorporated those in. Providence had some concerns. Those were incorporated in. It would certainly be my preference, if there's support on the committee, to move the bill without amendment. I think the bill has been through about as much conversation as it comes before you as it can be. And again, I would remind you of its unanimous support as it has moved through on the other side of the building.
There is some issue raised about the question of, does the attending physician have an inherent conflict of interest in making a decision to go forward with medical care? And I think that's the issue that was being raised here. And I think, you know, there may be some standing to that, but we'll keep in touch.
Good.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you for your courtesy in letting me testify and go.
Okay. I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on 579. We're in. Kevin, can you spend a minute on that before you have to go?
Thank you, sir.
We are still open on Senate Bill 204, and I know Mr. Earls needs to leave very quickly. He wants to testify on the Dash 4. So does David Schlachtis. Good. If you'd like to join us now, and then we'll get Jim Deagle and Scott Johnson from over the mountain.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Earls with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, here to testify on the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 204. And the kind of informal nature of my comments today are intended to be positive and to talk about, I think, both some of the issues that Representative Widener has raised or alluded to. It is prescriptive in a unique fashion, and it prescribes. It has the state prescribe to two private parties how they'll contract with one another. That's pretty unusual, I think. There are some advantages, I think, that could be created by such an approach. That
two private parties deciding how to spend state money.
Money that they receive under contract from the state. Yes. So I think the opportunity is to create more transparency, and the concept that we have discussed recently, as recently as last Wednesday, with Dr. Goldberg and his staff, and then on Thursday we convened a group of stakeholders from hospital representation and some of the Medicaid health plan representatives, and we talked through kind of what we each felt were the pluses and minuses. This is a fairly well-traveled path, as some of you know. Representative Greenlick, I know, knows. This came up last session. It was the subject of a budget note to the DMAP budget, I think, or DHS budget. There was an interim study around this issue. The interim study was staffed by DMAP. They produced a report. I have a copy of the report available for the committee, but it basically said, this is a good idea, but it's not ready for prime time. It needs further study. That was a specific recommendation. Then the Healthcare Leadership Council took up the issue in concert with the Health Policy Commission and looked at this same approach in a set of reforms under administrative simplification. And that group spawned its own work group. And that work group made a series of recommendations in the Oregon Health Policy Board's Health Incentives and Outcomes Committee report and recommendations, which was issued in November. And in both of those studies, the participants were really clear about two things. One, there are some opportunity created by moving to a standardized methodology, and Medicare could serve that purpose. And two, it should not be used to dictate rates. It should not be used as a mechanism to enact cuts. So there needs to be a crosswalk between a Medicare payment methodology and Medicaid payment so that funding is not affected. And in fact, Dr. Goldberg's staff has created a crosswalk like that in a conceptual form that works quite well. There is, however, now a document that emerged from the Health System Transformation Team that addresses this issue as a cost savings measure. And it now produces $51 million in cuts to Medicaid through the adoption of this payment system. And today I understand that there's a $12 million and a $16 million fiscal associated with applying it to PEB and OWEB. Our concern is you can kill a really good idea here if you try and enact payment, if you try and cut payments as part of the process of moving to a standardized payment methodology. If you separate, as the work groups have recommended,
those fiscals are savings, right? Not
they're I think that's an eye of the beholder.
No, I understand that, but from our formal fiscal, it would reduce budgetary expenditures. I understand the
concept. It would reduce funding to the Medicaid program.
Yeah.
So you could kill a really good idea here if you try and do something more than what has been discussed previously, which is to simply adopt a uniform payment methodology. If you take the next step and say, and by the way, we're going to cut payments into Medicaid, we're going to cut funding for Medicaid by $51 million, I think it really creates a lot of friction around what's a good idea. And with that, I take questions or conclude my comments.
Well, I know you also have a negotiation in the middle of, and we'll bring this one back for some
thank you
for some more discussion before we go further. Yes. Thank you very much, Kevin.
Co-Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Thompson, thank you very much for allowing me to speak to you today. My name is David Schlachtis. I am the CEO of Willamette Surgery Center here in Salem, and I'm also representing the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Associations. I'm going to have to do something that I don't often do, and that is I have to agree with the Hospital Association. It's fairly rare that we do that, but this is a wonderful idea. And I'm going to tell you why I think it's a wonderful idea, but I would first state that I agree with the Hospital Association that using it as a mechanism to also reduce funding when funding is incredibly low as it is, in our opinion, a really bad idea. We lose money every time an OHP, a Medicaid patient, walks into one of our surgery centers. So to cut funding even more and use this as a vehicle to cut funding any more is going to result in surgery centers saying, we're not the right avenue for this. And we don't want that. Right now, I'm proud to say that our surgery center does not turn away patients because of funding, no matter what kind of funding they have. The only time we push a patient to the hospital is because of comorbidities of medical conditions.
You have to.
But just to give you a little background on why this bill is coming up, currently within our industry, within, for instance, my surgery center, we have five different payment mechanisms. So we've got the old Medicare system, we have the current Medicare system. United Healthcare, in their infinite wisdom, has decided they don't like either of those, so they created their own payment system. We have the workers' comp system, which is slightly different, and we have percentage of billed charges. And so when we talk about administrative simplification, this is a bill that can be the platform that will create huge economies of savings for surgery centers throughout this state, getting them from five different systems eventually to one single system. To tie specific rates to it, we agree, is a very bad idea. But the other part of this that will help a lot is transparency for the patient. Right now, it's incredibly difficult. It's incredibly difficult for us to go argue with the insurance company in terms of how much we should be paid because they all have different, slightly different nuances to every kind of system. And so for us, it's really important that we end up with a system that is fair, that's transparent, that is simplified. And so as a result, we support this bill.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm not sure that's the Hospital Association's final statement.
We agree with the message.
We agree with that part. Okay. Thank you. Let me tell you in the room what we're going to do. We're going to ask Jim Deagle and Scott Johnson, who have come from way over the mountain, to join us now. They'll be the last two witnesses on this bill. Then we're going to finish the hearing we opened on 86A. The last session we have a couple of witnesses, I think, who want to testify to that. And then we'll go to a couple of bills where we have only two witnesses each. That will be 89A and 225. And then we'll finish up the session going as far as we can. Back on 579, there's a long list of witnesses, and we'll carry that. Did I miss something?
Yes, you did.
Oh, darn.
You go.
No, you go first.
And 91. Are there no...
It's a possible work session. Do you just want to carry that?
We'll carry 91 over. Jim, is that what we want to do anyway? Yeah. Okay. We'll carry 91 over till...
Monday.
Till Monday. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and Thompson, members of the committee. My name is Scott Johnson. I'm the director of Deschutes County Health Services. We're the public health, behavioral health county entity that provides services to residents of Deschutes County. I'm also the chair of the administrative council that supports the Central Oregon Health Council work that we'll describe to you and also describe the amendments that we're seeking. You have before you a packet of information. If I can refer you to the one pager on top, you'll see a number of graphics displays down the left-hand side. You have support letters from all of these organizations. And briefly, to describe who you have there, you have all three of the Central Oregon County standing in support for this amendment. This is 204A5. You have the hospital system. You have a fully capitated health plan. You have the federally qualified health clinics. You have the mental health providers. You have pretty much all of the primary players. You have the mental health organization as well for Central Oregon, and you have those support letters. Earlier, Senator Telfer referred to some of the benefits, some of the early successes we've had in our work over the last 18 months. Those are described to you in the background statement. And some preliminary results we're very excited about around emergency room diversion and also patient-centered medical homes. And in the interest of your time, I refer you to that. Happy to answer questions, but I won't go through those in detail. I would like to take a minute and describe to you the features of the A5 amendment so you know what it is we are in support of here. We've been working for 18 months, and we're really at a place where we see considerable promise in our work, and we need a formal mechanism to continue moving forward. What A5 does is it creates a four-year pilot for Central Oregon. So this is a pilot with a sunset of June 30, 2015. It creates for us the concept of a health referral region being Crook, Jefferson, and Deschutes counties. It includes a public and private representation on a health council board. It allows the council to have an advisory committee, and that really is a vehicle to bring all of our health care interests and organizations together towards a common goal. It would require of us a regional health improvement plan. You may be aware that in the health work we do within the region, we generate for a variety of jurisdictions and processes many silo health plans on a variety of topics. This unifies all of that work. It assigns responsibility for the Oregon to the Oregon Health Authority for creating the framework. So the state would say, What is all of the work that you need to do and all of the outcomes you need to address in doing a comprehensive regional plan? It would be then our responsibility to achieve that. We would then have a responsibility under the pilot to report to you both in 2013 and 2015 and on our progress. We stand in support of this and are confident that the main benefit we'll derive is it really will bring both public and private interests together, and that we can then continue to work on client satisfaction, patient satisfaction with the system, better health outcomes, and ways we can have shared savings as a result of our initiatives.
Thank you very much. Welcome. You've been a leader in this area for a long time.
Well, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chairs Greenlick and Thompson and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come over this afternoon. I'd like the record to reflect that I did bring the good weather over here and drove over in the Central Oregon, in my Central Oregon Cadillac, which, for those of you who may not know, is a pickup truck that has been washed before we come to Salem.
Could you mention your name?
Yes, sir. I am Jim Digo. I serve as President and CEO of St. Charles Health System in Central Oregon. We are a four-hospital health system based in Bend, Redmond, Prineville, and Madras. I reside in the community of Redmond, where I've served in elective office in years past. In addition, I wear a variety of other hats. I have been intimately involved in this initiative on the transition board that has really been working over the last 18 months. I've been involved since the inception of the start of Health Matters, which is the regional health collaborative that we have in the region that's been in place for many years. I am the incoming chair of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, chair their public policy committee, and and co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson. I also am the chair of the American Hospital Association Region 9 Policy Board, which is the entire West Coast hospitals, and serve on the American Hospital Association Board. So I bring a variety of perspectives to the work that we do. We are fully in support of this Dash 5 Amendment. We think that the work that has been done with integration in the areas of mental health, with the emergency department, et cetera, over the last 18 months or so is proving that innovation and a unique public-private partnership and approach to delivering health and human services in a coordinated fashion is really, we think, the wave of the future, and begins to look at healthcare delivery and health and human service delivery in a fully integrated fashion. I would also say that the reason we're bringing forward this particular amendment so late in session is we had been asked by the governor's staff and office to really not push this forward during a time that the transformational work group was doing its work and House Bill 3650 was finding its legs and its beginnings. So it wasn't because we lacked for want to do this, but we wanted to be respectful of the process of the legislature and the executive office to move that initiative forward.
That's because you had your guy running the process.
I'm sorry?
That's because you had your guy running the process.
I'll plead the fifth on that. Representative Greenlick, yes. Mike Bonetto, who serves as the governor's health policy advisor, most recently worked for us as the Vice President of Strategic and Community Benefit, did some great work for us, and we were glad to lend his intellect to the state. But we'd like him back at some point in time. Thank you, sir.
Do you see yourself as becoming one of those CCOs out of the transformation process?
You know, Representative Greenlick, we're looking at that. I think clearly on the national front, there's a lot of discussion around accountable care organizations, and the CCOs are a variation of that, but specific, obviously, to the state of Oregon. We're intrigued with the idea. We would like to see a little bit more detail on what exactly CCOs are, what they'll do, et cetera. I would be remiss if I didn't say that I always get a little nervous when organizations need to take on risk and manage risk without really the detail and the infrastructure to understand what that means. I think the idea of CCOs is forward-thinking, is very innovative, and we're tracking that. Obviously, whether St. Charles Health System is an organization or the Central Oregon Health Council or a related entity, or perhaps the local MCO, Pacific Source Health Plans. I think there's a variety of vehicles that could serve that purpose. I think it's highly likely in Central Oregon that it should be one entity. If there were competing entities, I would shake my head, because I think that just is about duplication, and that's one thing Central Oregon does well. We look for ways to eliminate duplication and overhead and inefficiencies, because frankly, in everything that you do and everything I do, we just don't have the resources to spend money where it shouldn't be spent.
Other questions?
Well, thank you.
Yes,
I just comment. I appreciate your answer. I serve on the Transformation Committee, and I too would like to see more detail about the CCO. So I agree with you that we'd like to see a model like Deschutes become a CCO, but I think we've got things we need to do to get you there. So I would look forward to maybe having more discussion on that topic, because you're closer to being a CCO than most other areas of the state. So,
that's the way it feels to me, too. That
yeah, we can learn something, I think, from what you're doing that might be part of the modeling for the CCO system, if that all comes together. But
I would agree, Mr. Co-Chair. We are unique in that we're geographically isolated, and I think there's a spirit of cooperation and collaboration in our region that may not necessarily be replicated everywhere else within the state, but nonetheless, if we can help demonstrate that, we're glad to do so.
Well, thank you both very much. Thanks for coming over. I hope
Thank you.
Come over just for this testimony.
I did, but it's not a worry. I have XM radio.
We appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, in your Cadillac ride.
That's right.
Yeah, those Cadillacs are cool-looking pickups.
let the record reflect, I don't have a Cadillac pickup. We just say a Central Oregon Cadillac is a pickup that's been washed. That's all.
Close. House Bill Senate Bill 204 and open Senate Bill 86 to continue reopen Senate Bill 86. And we have a couple of people to testify. One on the phone.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Doug Barber. Paul Newman. Is that right? And somebody on the phone. And again.
Terry Bunker. She was on Monday listening, so she,
oh, okay.
She's up to speed.
Terry?
Yes.
Yeah,
this is the House Health Care?
Yes, I'm Terry Bunker. Terry.
Okay. Chris Allman, too.
Yeah, we...
Can you still hear me?
We do. I can hear you.
Okay, great. The background noise was a little bad.
Chris,
you're before the House Health Care Committee, so there's some other people testifying on Senate Bill 86, and then the chair will call on you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, were you on the phone the other day?
I was listening.
Okay, well, why don't you start then?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Co-chairs, Representative Greenlick and Thompson, thank you. I was listening in on the phone on Monday to the testimony, and I was definitely interested in commenting on some of the things that were said. I provided written testimony, which I don't know if you've had a chance to look at or not, but some of the things that the questions that you were asking of Dr. Baskins, I wanted to comment on, and that it seemed like you were trying to get at maybe what was he promising that he would provide and what fees would he charge. And I'm not sure, you know, what his fees are, but I am very excited to provide this kind of a health plan, or not health plan, health care. See, there I go, making the same mistake that everybody else does, and that is confuse health insurance with health care, and they are not the same thing. I mean, what we need is for 80% of the people is primary health care, but yet we spend 80% of the dollar on the 20% of the population because we didn't spend the time 10 or 20 years ago making sure that their high blood pressure was taken care of, making sure that we talked to them about diet and exercise and taking their medications and getting these basic things taken care of that don't affect the person until 20 years down the road, when now we're spending a lot of money to fix something that we can't fix. And in primary care, the only way that we can even keep our doors open, and I own my own practice, is to turn the treadmill on this, you know, especially by seeing Medicaid patients. As you all know, it's very difficult to run practice with seeing Medicaid patients. I have been successful in doing that. However, as my practice gets larger, I've been not as successful in doing that because my providers that work for me are more easily burned out, and it's not their money. It's, you know what I'm saying? It's like I'm willing to work harder, but it's difficult to get other people to share your vision when you're seeing a very complex population such as a Medicaid population. So my whole goal with this is to turn the treadmill down, but yet charge less money. My would be based on something similar to what Washington State passed in 2007, which was a direct provider practice. And I'm putting my written testimony to you, but I'll just share it with you. They had three physicians who in Seattle who had a panel of just slightly less than 4,000 members, because they have to report to the insurance division once a year, and they were doing that 100%. So if you did the math on that, you know, an average patient sees a patient three times a year, and that's a person with insurance, you know, that would, you know, equal about 15 patients a day. And at a decent salary, at a salary that lets a person live in a way where they can feel happy about themselves and not go home stressed out because you've had to see 30 patients a day and wonder, you know, like why. But when Dr. Baskin says only 2% of primary care providers, physicians, are going into primary care, that's exactly why. And so we can see that nurse practitioners are going to be more and more providing primary care. And I'm afraid if we don't do something drastic to change that, we're going to burn out the nurse practitioners, and then what? So I see this as a way to provide people with health care and not health insurance. And I would base my program very similar to what Washington State has done, these doctors in Seattle. They're now offering a few more services, so they're charging a little bit more. But basically, it would be about, you know, $60 to $75 a month with maybe an annual fee of like $100 with debit or credit card. Now, you would get everything. You would get more care than you can currently get under the fee-for-service model, because I and my providers that work for me would be incentivized to answer email, answer phone calls, take care of stuff on the phone, take care of stuff on the email, take a text, you know, all sorts of innovative ways that now you just, if you, like if I take care of something over the phone for somebody, I don't get reimbursed for that. But so it's almost like going back to the capitated say sort of thing, but not really, because I'm actually providing a service for people. So it would certainly be well not acknowledged that this was not health insurance, and I have a broker, you know, person that I work with personally with my business that sells insurance plans, and I would encourage people to have a high deductible insurance plan, because this wouldn't cover that. But you know, with all of the medications costing so little anymore, really.
Chris, can I get you to round it up here pretty quick? We've got a bunch of people to testify, and we're running out of time today. If there's anything else you want to put in written testimony, you're certainly welcome to do that.
No, that's about all I want to say. It's not just about concierge medicine. It's about providing health care and not an add-on to somebody else's already existing Blue Cross plan.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome to stay on if you'd like, if your brothers, and listen to the rest of the testimony.
Do you want to
stay on? I can stay on, and if anyone has any questions, then they can ask me.
Okay.
Next.
Representative Thompson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. I'm pinch hitting for Dr. John Saltz, who was here on Monday hoping to testify when you ran out of time.
We're going to do it again.
Dr. Saltz is the chair of the Department of Family Medicine at OHSU, and they started a retainer medical practice 3 years ago at OHSU as an experiment, and they did it at two of their clinics, South Waterfront and Gabriel Park. Within the first year, they had 600 people sign up. Their target population was the uninsured. So they were looking to find people who did not have insurance, who needed primary care. They charged them $25 a month. For that $25 fee, they had access to all of the primary care that these clinics could provide, as well as email access, after-hour service. And the primary thing that Dr. Saltz wanted to convey is that there is one glitch in the bill as he read it, on the A. Engrossed version on page 2, lines 18 and 19, it says that the retainer medical practice may not require payment of a retainer medical fee for a period covering more than 1 month. He said, based on his experience over the last 3 years, that's not practical. Part of what you need in these practices is to keep your costs low. You need to know that your people are enrolled. What they do is they enroll people for a six-month period, and then they give them a discount if they enroll for a year. Dr. Saltz met with Teresa Miller and Anthony Behrens from the insurance division after Monday's hearing and talked with them about it, and they have, I believe, submitted a request for an amendment that would take those two lines out. They have agreed to it. It would work perfectly for Dr. Saltz and solve his problem. He thinks it's just a way to make these programs work based on his 3 years of experience.
I have a very quick question.
Please.
Are you finished? Sorry.
Are you finished?
I'm done.
Okay. I understand the process, and actually it sounds like a unique, interesting way for health care. But if people do this and the $25 a month and so on for the primary care, do they have to carry a catastrophic policy that's separate for hospitalization?
They have to carry the primary. I'm sorry, Chair Thompson, Representative Daugherty. The $25 only covers what is offered mm-hmm. in that primary care clinic. So if they are out of town,
yeah.
they have no coverage.
Right.
If they need to go to the emergency room, they have no coverage.
Yeah.
So either they need, I mean,
it's up to the individual.
It's up to them to.
I
mean, they're in the same boat they were in previously when they were uninsured, except that they have primary care, which for most people covers a lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for the clarification.
Really fast. Thank you. So how is this different from just a really stripped down insurance policy?
Chair Thompson, Representative Kennedy, it's a really good question. I would suggest asking the insurance division.
Okay, thank you.
Can I tell you a little bit how that's different than an insurance company? Is that you're actually paying for health care. You can get I can't charge an insurance company currently for a phone call, really, or an email, or a text, or anything like that that I could take care of without dragging a patient in.
Well, you're saying then that the patient has prepaid for that phone call, essentially, but you would not be able to charge an insurance company for payment.
Terry?
Uh-oh.
We lost him.
I didn't think it was that tough a question. We'll probably get back to that
issue. Chair Thompson, I think the tricky part is that some insurance plans are actually going to that where they do cover, in block payments, they do cover emails, they do cover phone calls. I mean, that's the trend. That's not where most plans are, but that is where they're headed. And so I think that is the question.
Okay. Anything else for Mr. Barber?
If we were to move this without amending page 2, line 18 and 19, would it still allow you to keep going with some coverage and then maybe fixing it later? Because I'd hate to see this bill get hung up because, to me, this is probably one of the best pieces of transformation that we'll move out of this health care committee.
I don't, Chair Thompson, Representative Widener, I think that this is a simple amendment that shouldn't hang the bill up at all. I think
you would be surprised at what can hang up a bill around here.
But from what Dr. Salt said, he thinks it would make these programs unworkable.
Okay, Paul, I guess you're next.
Thank you, Coach Thompson, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Paul Newman. I am a family doctor that has a private practice over the hill in Staten. I started my practice in 2003. And I have a partner now who's an osteopathic physician and nurse practitioner and a physician's assistant working with us. And I'm here to speak in favor of this bill. I want to tell you just a little bit about my practice and my patients that it would affect. You've heard a lot already about sort of the mechanics of it. I'm happy to answer any questions if those come up. My practice takes all insurance. We see Medicaid patients. We see Medicare patients. We even take TRICARE, which is difficult to find, in addition to private insurance. About 10% of our patients are self-insured, uninsured, if you will, and pay us directly for their services. This bill would address those 10% of patients who have no insurance coverage, nobody to cover their bill but themselves. I was attracted to this measure because of these patients coming to me repeatedly saying, what are you doing to help us with health care? Well, I can't fix the system, but if I'm able to help offer some sort of easy primary care access, that will be a good thing. My office will provide about 95% of the care to patients that walk through the door. Okay, I can't do angioplasties. I don't do colonoscopies. I can't take care of you if you need a bone marrow transplant, but 90% of what comes in my office I take care of, including diabetes care, hypertension, casting, vasectomies, skin biopsies, depression. We do a lot. And this care is affordable and convenient in a primary care office. Our impact on the healthcare dollar is minimal, and the benefit is tremendous. We prevent a lot of disease.
this method of prepayment for services is very efficient for patients. Right now, about 30% of my billing expense when a patient comes to see me is complying with insurance regulations, because the patients that come to see me are run through the same machinery that all the rest of the patients are seeing. And that only raises cost for them. I'll give you three brief examples of patients before I finish up who would benefit from this. I've spoken to a number of my patients about this Senate bill and about this plan. 100% of them have been ecstatic with the idea of having this sort of plan be legal. Wendy's a 48-year-old dairy worker. She has catastrophic coverage, and for her, this coverage was truly catastrophic. It's a high-cap coverage. It doesn't really allow care. So she didn't seek care. She's self-employed, doesn't have the money to pay routine care. She's been into the cardiologist recently, and poor outcomes. If her diabetes, if her hypertension, hyperlipidemia were controlled, she probably would have avoided some of these things. Speaking to her directly about this preventative plan, being willing to pay $50 or $60 a month to have basically all-you-can-eat primary care at the office, she was very pleased about that idea. This would benefit working individuals who have catastrophic insurance, don't have routine coverage. It would reduce barriers to care. Kate is a 55-year-old grass seed farmer I take care of who has no insurance and hasn't had a physical since I've known him for years. He comes in for the odd tractor accident or incident that requires my immediate care. I asked him about the possibility of paying a monthly fee to see me for what he needs, or my office being available by electronic or phone communication, doing in-office laboratories, lipid screening, A1Cs for diabetes. He said this would be something he'd sign up for immediately. And it affords affordable chronic care management. Dave is a 50-year-old patient of mine who is a part-time nurse, and he has asthma. He rarely comes in, even though he's a nurse and knows better. Speaking to him about it, he said, yeah, if I paid you $50 or $60 a month, I'd come in for my visits twice a year. I'd contact you more, not knowing that you'd tell me to come into the office because you're not going to get paid if you don't come in for an office visit. Practices benefit in addition to patients. It gives assurance that providing this service in Oregon is within the scope of the law. The clinics don't initiate these changes and then get shut down. And that simplifies billing and reduces expenses. I don't look at this as concierge care. I'm a primary care office. I don't have anything fancy. I'm not Botoxing my patients. I'm doing rectal exams. It's benefiting the working poor and the underinsured. It's an alternative method of payment. It's not necessarily revamping the entire system. Thank you very much for that opportunity to testify. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. You're Chris, right? Okay. Just one moment. I hate to do this, but we are going to carry over Senate Bill 89A. And Representative Clem is waiting for this, and it's just too important of a bill to not give adequate time to. I'm obviously pandering to get myself out of trouble on that one. We'll carry it over till Monday. And also Senate Bill 579A will have to carry over for those of you who are waiting on that one. And Chris, please continue.
Chair Thompson and members of the Health Care Committee. My name is Chris Allman, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. I went to medical school and graduated in 1984, went on to do my residency and finished that in internal medicine in 87, spent some time doing endocrinology fellowship training and working other places along the way, including the VA and Kaiser. And I have to say I have a lot of problems with this concept of a retainer fee. And it's not because I think that there aren't problems with the compensation for primary care. In fact, that's the reason why I left medicine in 1998. I'm married to a radiologist, and the big elephant in this room is the fact that there's gross income inequities in the specialties of medicine. And what I feel is happening is that primary care physicians are held hostage They're held hostage by insurance companies, and they're held hostage by the RUC. The relative value, relative RVS committee, it stands for Relative Value Scale Update Committee. And this committee is goes back a while from the AMA, and it is very procedure-oriented. And for that reason, for example, there's over 500 pages of codes that we have for the Oregon Health Plan, of which eight of them are oriented to the evaluation and maintenance payments for primary care doctors. In any case, while I understand why this is happening, it's hard, long hours that doctors spend calling up patients, emailing, whatever. I get it, and there is no adequate compensation. What I see is that there are different tiers that are being developed here. And on one hand, Dr. Chuck Kylo has gotten a lot of press for this kind of service that's available. In fact, last October, there was press in USA Today, again, using this tyranny of the visit explanation of what we need to get around. Yes, it is important that doctors have time with their patients to help them understand things, to dissuade them from doing procedures and tests and MRIs, absolutely essential. But on the other hand, when we have patients who have co-pays that are $500 for an MRI, and that underutilization that's going on right now, while insurance companies are making record profits and they're attributing that to being success in managed care, this is perverse thinking. So I feel that this is somewhat akin to the Stockholm Syndrome. Primary care doctors are being held hostage. And I don't feel that it's working well at OHSU. I looked at their study very, very closely. Their family practitioners, since this has been instituted, over half of their patients who are on this Project Access, over half of them make over 400% federal poverty limit. What does that mean? That means they pay the full fee for their visit. And their full fees for their visit range from $130 to $300 for the initial visit, $100 to $200 for return visits. That's in contrast to Oregon Health Plan, which is $30 to $147 and $15 to $102. There's a problem with reimbursements for primary care doctors. The problem goes to the heart of everything we're doing, to overutilization, to the high cost of medicine, which drives insurance rates up. This whole cycle has to be stopped. And so I hope that whatever happens in regards to all this is that this does not come out of the scrutiny of the insurance division, that indeed what is going to happen is there's going to be a good hard look at how many practices are starting to put this into place. What are the ranges of the fees? I've read some places, like in the New York Times, sometimes it's up to $12,000 a year. And remember, whatever rates they're talking about, it's per person.
I ask you to wrap it up. We've got another bill we have to hear yet, too.
Sure.
Thank you.
So that's my recommendation, is that the insurance division get some additional information to see how it's impacting insured and uninsured populations, too.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you again. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 86A, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 225A, and call Brian Barringer and Senator Monis Anderson will be following close behind. So, Brian, if you know how far it is to her office, that's how long you have. No, that was how long you have to testify, not to get here. Yeah. We cut you off as soon as she walks in. It's that easy, you know.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Baring with the Oregon Medical Association, and actually in a perfect world, since this is the Senator's bill, I would have followed her anyways and could have just said us too.
If you've been sitting in on this hearing today, you know it's not a perfect world.
Exactly, so. Exactly. Mr. Chair, the Oregon Medical Association supports Senate Bill 225. It's now, I think, in the A. Engross version, a really modest study, and we understand there's no fiscal impact, and what this would direct the Oregon Health Authority to do is to spend the interim collecting some data on scope of practice decisions. And we know, and I think the committee knows, that scope of practice decisions in this building are tough, very divisive, and we think that looking at some other states for some best practices and collecting some data and seeing what's going on around the country we'd be well served to collect that data, and we'd like to see what it is. So we support the bill. Do you want me to keep talking?
I gave you a license and you're not using it.
Oregon, medical.
Are there any questions for?
We like that it's 225. We think that's a good number for the bill.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Widener.
Since we have to kill time waiting for the senator, do you feel like you're above us when you can come up here with your tie a little crooked to testify to us?
Ouch, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener. It's crooked because my head is actually crooked. So.
Oh.
Representative Parrish.
So you said there's no fiscal impact on this?
I believe the department, there is no fiscal impact on this. My understanding is that they're going to absorb it through their workforce committee that they have existing. So.
Now. Yeah, Kennever.
Thank you. I guess the scope of practice of all health professionals
that they're studying?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kennemer, my understanding is that the study is to go look at how scope is reviewed. So it's not necessarily looking at different scopes. It's how scope of practice questions are addressed in other states.
I guess I'll ask that again. Thank you.
Or
Widener? I have to say, Brian, and with your collusion with the department, I just got upset over this with us going on, because here a department's willing to accept it and absorb it in the department, where I have a bill that deals with the department and they can do it in their normal course of business, and they say it's going to be $1 million fiscal. Hmm. So, I don't know. I think
some miracles.
There's something
that
we need to do.
You want to? I'll address that issue. I'm State Senator Lori Mona Sanderson, and I represent Gresham Trout Delwood Village in Fairview. And Senate Bill, as you probably know, 225, it directs the health authority to address issues relating to the scope of practice of health professionals and then report back to the legislature. In 2009, in the House Bill 2009, the health authority had set up a workforce group, and it also has a staff already devoted to research in health care through the Oregon Health Policy and Research Group. This is active. This is the type of things that they do. They do literature searches. And so this group is already active and going, and so I worked really carefully with them over the session and trying to make sure that it would be a part of what they already are doing. And we have used the Health Policy and Research Group a lot, and they and this actually doing a research study gathering, a lit search basically, on would be very easy, and you can have the health authority come up to talk to you about that. But that's answering your issue. I won't go into my testimony yet then.
Well, it's okay. Let's hear them, then I have some questions.
Sure. Every session we have proposals that want to expand or narrow the scope of practice of health professionals. And the review process is time-consuming, it's emotional, it divides the members, we become polarized. And so my foremost issue is public safety. And there are challenges when we're responding to these requests and counter requests. You know that we're going through the health care reform. We know that there is a workforce issue. And scope of practice, everyone is so territorial in their own scopes, as well as they are very, market share is huge for these various organizations. And so we find it difficult, members find it difficult in trying to address these scope issues. So in 2007, along with Representative Greenlick at the time, I formed a scope of practice advisory group, and it met in 2008. And that's where all the stakeholders, OMA, ODA, ONA, met with the physical therapists, et cetera, and came up with some recommendations and guidelines that they felt information that was needed when we're dealing with scope of practice issues. And they did come to consensus, and we have been following those guidelines that they have come up with. And we have been using this process, and it has been working quite well. But the method is they use a facilitator, and then they follow these guidelines. But the smaller professions are saying it is a cost to them, because it does cost several thousand dollars to have a facilitator to come together to try to come up to consensus. It's too bad they can't do it without a facilitator, but these issues are really, really very contentious. So that method may be the way that we need to continue with, but it is expensive. It is at a cost. And so that's why I would like the Oregon Health Policy and Research Group just to look, do a literature search, and see what other states are doing. And I think it's advantageous to our stakeholders. It's advantageous to us, because maybe there is a better method out there. So basically, I would urge your support. I talked with the Oregon Nurses Association and the naturopaths and Oregon Medical Association, and they certainly are supporting this bill. Thank you.
I'm going to go way out in the weeds. We've already decided we're going to deal with some scope of practice issues in the between sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Especially dealing with nurse practitioners, psychiatric nurse practitioners, and things like that. If OHA can do this and absorb the cost, I'm not sure we need a bill. We'll just engage them in the process of what we're going to be doing, you know, with this committee anyway, and continue that on. And I am a little bothered by the lack of a fiscal. Even if the employees are already there, there should have been a fiscal on a bill like this, I would think. And I bring that only up only because we're having the same problem with other bills that we've gotten in here, that some of them have huge fiscals for, you know, moving a file cabinet across the hall, and then others that require, you know, building a building and hiring a team come back with no fiscals. So I have a little bit of a problem with fiscals this session, but that's another matter. But
I hear what you say. I just am very aware of the workforce group that's working in the Oregon Health Authority, and then also knowing what the Oregon Health Policy and Research Group, and they just do literature searches all the time.
Representative Kennemer.
I guess I'm just having some trouble understanding, and I agree. I mean, these turf fights are tough, and we get into them often. And they are unresolvable ultimately, because they come back in variations. So, but I just am a little puzzled by how the health authority is going to do this in some kind of rational, objective way. Because it's really about reimbursement and power.
Oh, this is only...
Just don't understand. So, I mean...
Oh, no, this bill isn't going... This bill is only going to come, bring to us, bring to the legislature what other states are doing. So they are only going to be doing a literature search for what is happening in other states, how they resolve the issue of scope of practice. They're not going to come up with a
scope of practice for individual
professions. Not for individual professions. Right now we have a process in which we get the two sides together with a facilitator, and it worked with the naturopaths. It actually worked with the psychologists, psychiatrists too, except
I might differ with you.
It worked with the assembly. It just was vetoed by the governor.
Representative Parrish.
Well, thank you, Chair, because I think I'm actually going to go deeper in the weeds than you. I, by virtue of sitting on four committees this session, I'm troubled by the value set and the lens that we use in one committee. It does not have the same value set and lens as another, and yet the issues are the same. They're just different topics. It could be health care, it could be education, it could be veteran services. And I sit on veterans, and something that you just, you know, we'll absorb it into our day and get it done, which I'm grateful that they're willing to absorb something and get their day and get it done, comes back to me in another committee on a different bill with $133,000 fiscal. It's going to take 2 years for them to Google how we handle credits for soldiers or, you know. I'm kind of concerned about that. But then again, applying that same, as you're talking about scope of practice, here we're talking about potentially do we let nurses prescribe, but, you know, we can't let somebody who's teaching at a community college teach a high school kid. It's a problem, I think, across, you know, all of our committees that these things, we don't weigh them with the same lens. I appreciate you trying to find a way to solve it for the health care.
I've had so many members come to me and say, Lori, we need to have a process that is not contentious, not emotional. It's just coming to us and saying, solve the problem. I was even thinking the board should be able to solve these problems, but that hasn't been the practice. So I think
my other concern is that if that we would need a bill for all of these types of things when have we created a structure in government where the initiative process for somebody to bring something to us and say, here, we've actually solved it and you don't need to have a bill, can you adopt this? It doesn't seem to exist as much as I would hope it would. So
it would be nice. It would be nice. But that's why we are elected, to solve these real... why we're paid the big bucks to solve these really...
Any other questions? Representative Widener.
This probably be for Brian, and then it's probably going to go to the department as well. Why do we need to legislate somebody's job? Either people are doing their job or they're not doing their job. If they're not doing their job, usually they get fired. So if we have people that are in place for doing this already and supposed to be doing the literature research and they're not doing it, why are they not being fired? Then for the OMA, it's something they could do and bring to us as well, without a bill, and say, hey, this is what the scope of practice is on average across. I mean, I could probably Google it and within an hour have most of the stuff here if we're just talking literature research.
It is a literature search.
I mean, with it being a literature search, I'm just trying to figure out the needs for the bill as well. I mean, because now we're starting to have to craft everybody's job description. And to me, that shouldn't be the legislature's job.
And with that final word, I want to thank you for your attendance. And we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 225A. And if there is no further work before us today, we're okay. We will adjourn the House Health Care Committee.
No meeting on Friday.
Thank you for your help.